We're taking up the sin of the golden calf, specifically the prayer of Moshe, Rabbeinu, when Moshe was told about it. So this is on chapter 32, verse 7. This takes place when Moshe is on Mount Sinai for the 40 days and 40 nights, and God is giving him over the rest of the Torah and all of the interpretations which will constitute the oral law. It was Moshe's departure from the Jewish people which, in a manner of speaking, triggered off the event, as the Torah points out, that they saw that Moshe was late in returning. Whether he actually was late or whether that was just their own perception given their state of nervousness is not the issue right now. And we're not going through all the factors which caused them to do what they did. There's many problems associated with that. That's a separate issue. We're not going to take it up right now. We're going to pick up the story from the point where God communicates this to Moshe. Moshe, of course, is not aware of this. Interesting, even though we know that Moshe is a prophet and Moshe reached the highest level of prophecy, that doesn't mean to say that because you're a prophet, you know everything that's happening at every time and every place. Contrary to the contemporary view that people have, when they attribute prophetic powers to an individual, irrespective of whether that individual truly has them or not, but they sort of have the notion that this person knows everything. The idea that there's anybody that knows everything simply doesn't exist within Judaism. Even a prophet, of course, we do maintain there's such a thing as prophecy, and there were prophets. Conceivably, there could be prophets today, there could be, but one would have to establish the fact that he does possess prophecy according to the requirements that the Torah has set for that. It can't be established by a mere claim. The claim has to be tested. It has to be verified through the established procedures. And certainly can't be established by the fact that people, multitudes or a whole following of people, believe that this person has special powers. That's, of course, an absurdity. But people do have that sense. And when they have the sense that this person has certain kind of prophetic powers, along with it goes this idea that this person knows everything about you, knows everything about everything. That, of course, is utter nonsense, because even a genuine prophet, as Moshe Rabbeinu, does not know everything, only those things that God chooses to reveal to him. As we see in this case right now, he didn't know about the sin of the golden calf until God told him about it. So in verse 7, God said to Moshe, go down from the mountain, rejoin the people, because the people, your people, has been corrupted, has corrupted itself. They've acted in a corrupt manner, alluding, of course, to the sin of idolatry, the worst possible sin that there could be. The entire foundation of Judaism and any human perfection is the recognition of the true idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to relate to God. You have to have the correct idea of God. The person has a falsification of God, so he has nothing. What he's relating to is something which he's imagining in his own mind. That, of course, is the most difficult achievement for an individual, to free himself from false deifications and attach himself to the true concept of God. Asher ha'leisa me'eretz Mitzrayim, that you took out of Egypt. Saru maher, they have turned aside very quickly, min ha'derech, from the derech. It's a very interesting way of putting it. It's sort of a bit of a generalization over here, that it's not referring to a particular, but it's more that they've turned away from a path. That indicates that there's a specific path. I commanded them in a particular kind of a path. And we'll soon see the significance of what that path is. Because that itself is strange. Well, why describe it that way? Why not say that they committed idolatry? Which that comes next. They had made for themselves a molten image, a graven image of a calf. But that's preceded by saying they turned aside from the path. What is that path? Vayishtachvu lo vayizbechu lo, and they bowed down to it, and they sacrifice to it. Vayomru, and they said, Eile Elohecha Yisrael, these are your gods, O Israel, Asher Halucha Me'arath Yisrael, who brought you up from Egypt. Vayomar Hashem al Moshe, and God said to Moshe, Ro'isi es am hazeh, I have seen this people, V'hine am k'shei orafu, and behold, they're a stiff-necked people. V'ata hanicholi, and now, so to speak, of course, let go of me. Let go of me. Leave me alone. Of course, God speaks in the language of man, obviously. It's as though Moshe is sort of hanging on to him, but of course, you can't hang on to the Shekhinah, to the presence of God. But that's what God chooses to say. Hanichali, leave me alone, v'yichar api v'hem v'achalim, and I will allow my anger to kindle against them, and I'll destroy them. V'yasa oscha l'gai gadol, and I'll make you into a great nation. Here we encounter a very, very interesting and a most unusual idea. And I'll put it in the form of a question. The Jewish people are not an ordinary people. They're different, they're unique. They're a class by themselves. There's no other people that's in the same class as the Jewish people, in the sense that they are a chosen people. And this leads us to the question, can God destroy a chosen people? Can a chosen people be destroyed? By definition. The fact that God made a covenant and promised that they'd be a great nation is part of the idea, but that in and of itself, I think we could perhaps answer and say that all the promises that God made presuppose that the Jews would fulfill their end of the covenant. That is to say, if the Jews refuse to fulfill it, if they are no longer the Jewish people, so then, as far as God's promises are concerned, we can understand that. The promises only relate to them as long as they're living a certain kind of a life that defines them as being Jewish. But there's another thing that's troubling me over here. When I raise the question, can you destroy a chosen people? I think that for most people, since they have a faulty notion, they don't have a clear idea of what it means that the Jews are the chosen people. I'm talking about observant Jews. I think they understand it in that we're closer to God, or God likes us and we're special, that type of thing. According to that idea, if that's all it means, that we have a different kind of a relationship, so then it's not automatically a problem. It's not inherently a problem. Therefore, I could say, okay, we deserve that relationship when we live on a certain level, but when we no longer live on that level, we don't deserve it. And God can destroy a chosen people, because it has to do with merit. But that's because that's a false idea. That's not the idea. God did not choose a people so that there'd be a people that are treated differently or are closer to Him, get special benefits. That's not what we mean. The idea of the Bechira, of the chosenness, is to be an instrument for God's purposes in perfecting mankind. It's tied in with God's purpose in Bria, in the creation. That's why God selected a people to be the teachers of mankind, to teach them about God, to teach them Torah, insofar as they need to know Torah in order to have the basics of perfection. That's the idea. So the chosenness of the Jews is tied in with God's purposes in creation. So if there won't be a Jewish people, how could there be a world? That means that God's going to have to destroy the world. There's no longer any purpose in having a world. So how can you destroy the chosen people if the purpose of the chosen people is to be the teachers of mankind? Again, if the purpose of the chosen people is to be the teachers of mankind, and if this is an integral objective of the creation, were it not for my covenant day and night, God says in the prophets, then the laws of nature, heaven and earth, would cease to exist. God created the world for a purpose. And that's why you have the phenomenon of the flood. What does the flood mean? That means that if mankind should reach such a state of corruption so that it no longer is fulfilling its human purpose, it will no longer exist because God created it for a purpose. And God is a perfect creator. And if the creation, because it was endowed with free will, goes against the purpose, it does have built into it the capacity for self-destruction. That's the flood. Now, after the flood, we have the instrument, the divinely chosen instrument to be the teachers of mankind, to enable them to arrive at their purpose. That's the Jewish people. That's the chosen people. How can you destroy the chosen people? What will happen to the world? That's the question. Moshe, of course, does not use that argument, or does he? We'll see. That's very crucial. Moshe, in formulating his response, does he make use of this argument, or does he have different arguments? It's being said, but we do see that the world did exist prior to the selection of the Jewish people. The answer to that is that the world was able to exist because the plan was that there would be a people at a certain point in time, which would be the teachers of mankind. So it took time. The development of the Jewish people is something which unfolded through the natural order. It wasn't just a miraculous thing in the sense that God just brought the Jews into existence, as God brought the world into existence. God's providence guided the founders, Abraham, Isaac, but there was a natural process that took place, development, centuries, until they were ready. So therefore, the world was able to exist before that because it was leading up to the establishment of the Jewish people. So therefore, the existence of the Jewish people was crucial, was essential. Now, however, if they're going to be destroyed, so then how can there be a world without any Jewish people or any hope of a Jewish people, a chosen people, on the horizon? That is why we can understand the pasuk. The fact that this is true, that you cannot have a world without a chosen people, is borne out by the pasuk. Because when God says to Moshe that I will destroy them, leave me alone, Hanichali, leave me alone, and I'll destroy them, it says, Asa Eschalagai Gadol, and I'll make you into a great nation, which means to say that God is sort of taking the rug away from under Moshe. Moshe can't come back and argue. You can't do that. You can't use that argument, what about mankind? Because God is saying, I understand that. Obviously, I'm just attributing those words. God is saying that there will be a chosen people, but this one failed. Failure. And I'll make a new one out of you. You'll be the leader. So don't think you're going to get out of this, so to speak, by saying you can't do that because mankind needs a chosen people. Mankind will have a chosen people, but it'll reconstitute them from you. That puts Moshe in a very difficult position now, because the logical retort would have been what I just said. But God has already taken care of that. God has said that there will be a chosen people, except I'll make a new people out of you. This people failed. So now, this is the background for the response of Moshe. Now we'll read on 11 the response of Moshe. Vayechal Moshe es p'nei Hashem Elokav. And Moshe entreated the face, so to speak, of Hashem, his God. Vayomer, and he said, Loma ad Hashem, yechara apcha v'yamecha. Why would you allow your anger to be kindled against your nation, Asher Hotzeisa me'eretz Mitzrayim, that you removed from the land of Egypt, Bechoch Gadol, Uviyat Chazaka, with great power and a strong hand? Lama Yomer Mitzrayim Lema, why should the Egyptians say, Biro'o Hotziyam, with evil intentions, did he take them out? La'arogosam Behorim, to kill them in the mountains, ulachalosam me'alpneho adama, and to destroy them from the face of the earth. Shuv mecharon apecha, return from your state of anger, v'hinachem al hara liamecha, and turn aside from the evil that you plan to do against your nation. That is the first argument. Let's analyze it. The basis of this argument is that for you to do so would constitute a desecration of your name, Chil Hashem. It's interesting that he's making reference to the Egyptians, because at first glance one would say, why should we care about the Egyptians? They were our oppressors. However, he's making use of the Egyptians. That's the illustration. Because the nation apparently, that had the closest experience with the Jews, and the ones that would be watching the developments most closely would seem to be the Egyptians. Because it was that nation that God sent his signs to, and the purpose was that they should recognize God. So in spite of the fact that they dealt evilly with the Jews, the purpose of God was to bring them back to the truth, to save them, to recognize their evil ways. It does seem a little bit strange, though, that what Moshe is saying is that the Egyptians would say that God took them out with the intention of destroying them. It would seem more in line with, at least my way of thinking, is that they perhaps would say that God didn't have the power to bring them into the land. However, perhaps it's a combination of things. That is, given the idolatrous mentality that they could not really free themselves from being under the influence of those elements, physical things, and they couldn't imagine that there was something outside of the universe that didn't partake of physicality at all, and therefore was responsible for all the diverse phenomena in the universe, the Supreme Being. They couldn't really free themselves from being submerged into the visible. So that's the essence of an idolatrous approach, that there's a diversity of phenomena, and every specific element has its own cause, separate causes. So they project many, many different gods onto the universe. You see, the Egyptians had a system of many idols. Each one is responsible for a different thing. So therefore, they would say that this god was mighty, was great at being able to extricate them and being able to inflict punishment on the Egyptians, but it couldn't bring them through the wilderness. Didn't have those kinds of powers, and therefore just destroyed them. But in doing so, it would also gratify their emotions, because what happened was a tremendous emotional breakdown of the Egyptians, that they were subjected to all of this punishment. Of course, they naturally considered themselves superior to the Jews, superior to the other nations, because of the endowments that they had with the Nile and the rich agriculture and all of that. So therefore, this had to be a tremendous blow. The idea that, no, we're not the favorite ones, but the Jews are the favorite ones. So, if things happened, and it could be interpreted to remove that pain, that recognition that the Jews are the favorite ones, that we were punished, you see? It's not that, look what happened to the Jews. So they got destroyed. So that would be the motive. That is to say that it was all a big setup in order to bring them out and to destroy them. In either case, however, the argument of Moshe is that your whole purpose in selecting a people would be very much compromised, would be seriously undermined, because the entire purpose is for the world to recognize God. And once you've already designated the Jews, and once you perform these miracles for them, and now you go ahead and destroy them, even though, he's not arguing that it's not just. You have a very interesting situation. There's the actuality, the real reason, their sin, and they may deserve it. Moshe's not saying they don't deserve it. Interesting. They deserve it. But how will it be interpreted? By mankind. Mankind will interpret it in accordance with their preconceived notions. And it will only serve as an insurmountable barrier towards the proper recognition of God. Already they will look at the idea of God in a negative light, because this will have turned out to be a tremendous failure, and they won't be able to get over that failure, to the extent that it would be desired that mankind should have a very positive idea about God. Lahavdil, of course, we're making an analogy. It's but just in a manner of speaking, that it could be, for example, sometimes a person wants to do something, And maybe it's necessary to do that thing. Let's say a person is sending out on a mission, and the objective of the mission was to establish peace in the world. So he wants to convince people that he's a tremendous peacemaker. But let's say a situation arises and he encounters some very, very evil people, very wicked people, and he has no choice except to annihilate them, the entire bunch. So you may say, well, that in and of itself is going to disqualify you. Either get somebody else to do that or overlook that. Because as a result of that, even though if people understood the proper reason, if people understood why you're really doing it, they wouldn't hold it against you, but that's not the way they're going to look at it. They're automatically going to attribute certain aggressive impulses and motivations to you as a result of this, and you'll never be looked at as a peacemaker. It's just not going to happen. Perhaps in a sense, this is why David HaMelech couldn't build the Mikdash. The ultimate objective of the Mikdash, of the Holy Temple, is to bring peace in the world. And to the extent that it was associated with David, who was a warrior his entire life, and even though there's a justified wars, but it's not going to help. Perhaps that's somewhat of the idea over here, that once you do this, that's what people are going to remember. And it's going to be a problem, so to speak, in your reputation. Again, so to speak. I think God has a reputation. I'm just using these terms. But this is what Moshe is saying. People won't get past this. And the idea, the type of respect, the type of recognition of God's awesomeness and God's omnipotence and God's justice, people won't be able to get past this. If you do this to the Jews, so even though they deserve it, that's not the point. It's irrelevant. In terms of your purpose, this would create a serious impediment. That's argument number one. I should point out before we go further is that one can ask the question, what gave Moshe the right even to intercede? God had made a decree that he's going to destroy the Jews. Now Rashi points out that the way God spoke to Moshe, communicated to Moshe, V'yata hanicholi, and now leave me alone and I will destroy them. So the expression, and now leave me alone, implies somewhat that God is saying that you are holding me back. That is to say that the Rashi says that from this, Moshe understood that the matter was contingent upon him. That God is saying, only if you leave me alone. But if you don't leave me alone, then you will be able to stop me. There is a way in which you could stop me. And from that, Moshe at least derived the idea that there was something he could do. And then he launched, of course he had to think it through, and then he launched into the prayer. However, the simple meaning would be that had Moshe not prayed, then this is what would have happened. I understand the difficulty at the outset, that is to say, but once we see the arguments of Moshe, which basically are just bringing to light truths that were already there, that God, of course God knew this argument, that God did not need Moshe to make the point, that it would constitute a desecration of his name vis-a-vis the Egyptians, and we'll soon see the second argument, once we understand what it is. Of course it's something that God knew, thus raising the question, if it's something that God knew, so then how could God have thought to destroy the Jews, whether Moshe would have made the point or whether Moshe would not have made the point. So of course we're going to deal with that question. Once we understand what the arguments are, the next question will be, so, but they're truths. Why does Moshe have to make these points in order to save the Jews? The implication is, had Moshe not made these points, Jews would not have been saved. But they're truths. Now we're going to proceed to the second argument. That's on verse 13. Zechor li Avram. Remember Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yisrael. That's a reference to Yaakov. Avodecha, your servants. Hashem ishpat lahem bach, v'atidavar alehem, that you swore to them in your name and spoke to them and said, Arbe azarachem, I'll increase your descendants, your children, kechoch v'yashamayim, as the stars of the heaven. And all of this land that I spoke about, I will give to your children. V'nochal li'olam, and they will inherit it eternally. The next pasuk says that v'yinachem al Hashem al ha'ra, that God changed his mind, so to speak, changed his position. Of course, God doesn't change his mind. We said this endless amount of times. It's just descriptive. It's as though concerning the evil that he had said, salute to his nation. What is the second argument, though? Let's analyze it. And what are the difficulties in seeking to understand it? It seems to be difficult. What is the appeal to the fathers? It's true, so God made a promise. Here it doesn't seem that he's saying that the world will say you don't keep your promises. Unless you want to argue that. But that doesn't seem to be the case. Because that's something that the entire world didn't know about, it would seem. That's something we only know about through the Torah. So that's not what he's saying. In the first case, with regard to what the Egyptians would say, and it's not just the Egyptians, the whole world, because the whole world knew about the Exodus. The whole world knew about the splitting of the Red Sea. So everybody was watching, everybody was going to learn from this. And if the whole thing ends as a catastrophe, that's the end of the story. But here it's a different point. Oh, it's a God promise to the others. Why is that so significant? And is it a matter that you can't break that promise? Again, one can say that that promise was contingent on the assumption that if the Jews would do what they had to do, if they were worthy, if they had free will. The promise didn't mean to say that God would take away their free will. So if the Jews aren't deserving, the fathers will understand, I would imagine. Moreover, it's a very difficult argument. Because in general, when we employ these kinds of arguments, secondary arguments, that is, I can't get you to do something for my sake, because you don't care about me. But if you do this, it'll hurt someone you respect. It'll hurt your parents. So do it for the sake of your parents, because they'll be very bothered by it. That might resonate with you. You may say, you're right, I'm not doing it for you. For you, I don't care. But since I know that it'll hurt my parents, I don't want to hurt them. But that presupposes that they're around, that they're going to be aware of it. In this case, they're not here anymore. The ones to whom the promise was made, they're not here. They're not going to. Are they going to find out about it and get upset about the fact that you didn't keep the promise? That's what's difficult about this argument. If the essence over here is the promise per se, that you made a promise, you can't break it, then why not? If the Jews have sinned grievously, that's what God said. So are Meyer. They've turned aside. So if it's just because once you made a promise, you can't break the promise, it doesn't seem that that's what Moshe is saying.
Maybe only part of the promise is conditional.
It's being suggested perhaps that one aspect of the promise was unconditional, and that is they'll inherit the land eternally. However, it doesn't seem to be the case. The land cannot be disassociated from the purpose. The inheritance of the land is because that is the venue. That is the arena. That's the area in which God's nation will manifest his existence through the temple, through the society, through the way of life, through the knowledge. That particular piece of land. So if you remove Judaism from the Jewish people, then they have no right to the land. There's no purpose for them to be in the land. I know that's a very, very controversial issue today with reconstituted Zionism and the idea of a Jewish people returning to the land, however, not for this purpose. A Zionism which is removed from Torah is very, very deficient, let's put it that way. However, we look at it practically. We support the Jewish people, and our task is to strengthen its association with Torah. And when it is fully associated with Torah, then its legitimacy in the land will be complete. But I'm not implying, heaven forbid, in a political sense. I'm not trying to give any kind of strength to our enemies who have no right whatsoever and who seek to destroy Jewish existence in the land of Israel. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that from a political standpoint, the Jews have 100% right to be there. From a metaphysical point of view, our right to be there is contingent upon fulfilling the promise, fulfilling the Torah in the land of Israel. And to the extent that we fail to do so, to that extent, our existence there is not on the firmest footing. Let's take a look at Rashi on verse 13. The heading is to Abraham, to Yitzchak, and to Israel. So Rashi says, if for burning, if that's the intention, then remember Abraham, who gave himself over to be burnt for your sake, for your name, in Ur Kasdim. According to Chazal, he was cast into the fiery furnace because he wouldn't renounce his belief in God. If for the sword, remember Yitzhak, who stretched out his neck at the Akedah. If for exile, then remember Yaakov, who was exiled to Haran. And if they cannot be saved because of their merit, still not enough, all of this, then what are you saying to me? I'll make you into a great nation. If a stool of 3 feet, 3 legs, cannot stand up before you at the time of your anger, then how much more so a stool of 1 leg? What you see from this is that the way we look at the avos and the imahos, the fathers and the mothers, is different than how any other people looks back at its founders. That is to say that the lives of the avos, the matriarchs and the patriarchs, is not just a historical phenomenon. It's an integral element in the day-to-day life of the nation. It's a component of Klal Yisrael. That's why the Torah records the events that occurred to the avos. The avos are very unique people. They're prototypes. You have Avram, you have Yitzhak, and you have Yaakov, and of course the imahos, you have 3. And our identity is, interestingly enough, it mentions Yisrael, because we are, our identity is Bnei Yisrael. It's to the extent that we identify with the avos and we internalize their attributes, that is our identity. They reached the ultimate level of perfection in terms of how people ought to live their lives. People whose philosophy, whose approach to life is rooted in the true system of ideas, abstract ideas, but it's not just abstract ideas, it's internalizing and molding your character and your confrontation with the vicissitude, so to speak. Well, that's the whole idea of Masa Avos Simon Labanim, that the activities of the fathers are a sign for the children, that they encountered every possible situation that one who lives his life on the basis of these principles would encounter, and they achieved that level of understanding, of courage. They knew how to act in the most appropriate manner, which is in line with the divine providence, with the will of God and the manifestation of providence. That the whole idea of the blessings that Yaakov gave to his children had to do with the transmission of those ideals to the children who were to be the Shvatim. Thus, all of the great leaders of the Jewish people, and then you have great heroes in the period of the Tanakh, for example, and great heroes throughout all of Jewish history, in one way or another, it's not creating anything new. From the standpoint of their activities, their behavior, how they dealt with situations in a perfected manner, is not creating anything new. There's nothing new to be created. It's always looking back and finding the precedent in the lives of the avos. They're always manifestations of the life, the philosophy, the behavior of the avos. Let me see if I can give an example. When Mordechai was confronted with this situation, the imperative, the order to bow down to Haman, and his understanding was that this would constitute idolatry, because Haman had fashioned himself into an idol, an ideology of human might. So he couldn't acknowledge that. And therefore he refused. And when he refused, he knew the consequences. So he was prepared to give up his life rather than to violate idolatry. Was this something new that was coming into being? Was this a replay of something that had happened before? Well, this is a replay, because that's exactly what Avraham did by the Kivshan Ha'esh. That's why the study of the incidents, the lives of the others, and by the way, it's not biography. You do not find biography in the Torah. The accounts about Avraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, no biographer would write this way. From a biographical point of view, you're frustrated. You really know very, very little about them. Hardly anything. There's nothing there to construct the biography. To the contrary, the world, the nations of the world, they also have heroes, they have founders, founding fathers, that they may admire, and there are tons and tons of biography written about them. For example, let's take Abraham Lincoln. He may not be the founding father, but let's look at him as though he's an icon. He's looked up to as being a great father of this nation. And there are thousands and thousands of pages of biography. What is the difference between someone like an Abraham Lincoln, if you want to use the example of George Washington, you may do so, and someone like Avraham Avinu? I don't mean the difference in terms of their greatness or their values. I'm talking in terms of their role vis-a-vis the people that look up to them as being founders. Let me give you an example. This is a very difficult time for the leaders of this country, facing a tough decision with regard to going to war with Iraq, not to go to war, and so forth. I would doubt very much that whatever the leaders of President Bush and others, who they're consulting with and what processes they're going through, I doubt very much that anybody is going to turn to Lincoln and try and find out what would Lincoln do in this situation. I just don't think so. However, as I said, the leaders, the Jewish leaders throughout the centuries, whenever they would have an important meeting with the Gentile authorities, confrontation, they would always study the parasha of Yaakov going out to meet Esav to discover, to look for significance and meaning and relevance. Because we don't regard that as being something of the past. We regard it as being eternal. Eternal in terms of the knowledge, in terms of the principles, in terms of the correct emotion that one should have in that situation to derive inspiration, and so on and so forth. An American, however, would say, yeah, Abraham Lincoln was a great man in his context, but we've moved on to a different context and there is no real connection between the two. That's looking up to someone as a father, as a founder, who started something in the past and the thing developed and kept developing, and now it's a completely different situation, but we look back and we have respect. But we can't respect him in terms of creating some type of influence or some type of an ability to understand which will carry forth through all the generations. That you don't have. However, the idea of the Avos is something which is an eternal feature. It must be there. That's the whole idea of the Maaros HaMachpelah, for example. That's the significance of the Maaros HaMachpelah, to serve as a concrete reminder of the Avos. Chazal say that Kalev, when he was one of the spies, he went to the Maaros HaMachpelah and he drew inspiration from the lives of the Avos. So I think that the second argument is, interestingly enough, you see that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to achieve a completely different level of appreciation of Klal Yisrael. That Klal Yisrael is a very, very delicate instrument. It's a special creation of God. It didn't come into being magically, and it has many, many elements and many components to it. And that feature of the relationship of the people to the ideal and the example, the role models of the Avos, is an integral component of the identity of the Jewish people, and it is something that can't be duplicated. It cannot be duplicated. Will not be found again. The Jewish people are what they are and have achieved what they've achieved because, in addition to studying the Torah, the abstract aspects, to studying the principles, the mitzvos. There's a lot of abstract knowledge in the Torah. But then there are certain things, apparently, that cannot be communicated in a purely abstract manner. And what is that? There's one word in this parsha that mentions it. There's something that you sometimes you can't communicate by abstract principles, but you can communicate through episodes, through recounting specific episodes, illustrations of what people did in what situations. What's the word? The word is derech. There's a derech achayim over here. The derech achayim, the way of life of the others. Interestingly enough, what God said, saru maher, they turned away very quickly, they had derech, from the derech that I commanded them. So an integral component of Yahadus, aside from the abstract ideas, is something, I guess, which is a bit intangible, but it's like derech ha'avos, it's the way of the avos. Any great leader, any gadol, has to incorporate within himself not just the ideas, the abstract ideas, but also a certain sensitivity to the derech ha'avos, to the way of the avos. What's the way of the avos in a situation like this? Let me give you an example. Today, there's a major idea or a certain approach which I guess can be called political correctness. And that is that we just have to accept everyone, acceptance. Of course, everything has within reason, intolerance. And the truthfulness of a position is not as important as the idea of maintaining a certain unity. We just we have to respect all opinions, that type of thing. I guess I would assume within reason. So that's within Orthodox, Conservative, and Reform. Of course, then there are people, well, the more liberal you are, the more you're going to push inclusiveness, because you want yourself to be included. But even within Orthodoxy, there's, you know, the sense that there is no one right way, no one wrong way. You just have to be tolerant. All right, you have a right. You express your view, he expresses his view, and that's as far as we can get. Is that really the derech avos? The derech avos is, to the contrary, the most important thing is to seek to discover the truth, that there is a truth, and there's one true idea, and there are false ideas, and the objective of life is to try and discover the truth and to try and reject false ideas, to reject falsehood. That's what Avraham Avinu did. After he discovered the true idea, he engaged in debates with other people to break down the false ideas. And he promoted the truth. Today, you don't have that kind of a thing. So, I'm not saying to disrespect people. I'm saying that the idea that whatever, any hashkafa, so to speak, is as good as any other one, and we have no way of knowing what the truth is, that's another very powerful idea today. We have no way of knowing what the truth is. That's contrary. That's contrary to Judaism, but it's not the derech avos. And you see throughout our history that the greatest gedolim never confused respect for the person. That the Ramban had the greatest respect for the Rambam, the greatest veneration, but that had absolutely nothing to do with the manner in which he dealt with the ideas. He felt free to use his own mind to critique, to criticize, to analyze, and to give his own opinion when he disagreed, to accept the Rambam when he agreed. So the notion of respect for a person means to put aside your own mind. That's another very powerful idea today, is that we just have to read what the authorities have said of the past, but we can't think of it for ourselves. It's another, that's not the derech avos. There's a certain derech that people utilize in their approach to Judaism. Certain derech. You can't put it into words necessarily. Certain approach. And the question is this the derech avos? So I think that really this is what Moshe was saying. That the whole metaphor of the stool with three legs. The three legs, of course, are the avos. And it expresses the idea perfectly, because that's the foundation. And you can't, the chair can't exist without the foundation. So you can have a firm foundation, and you can have a foundation of one leg. Now, of what difference is it in a situation like America, where you look at the founding fathers as simply an aspect of history? It's a historical phenomenon, and we've moved past that. Does it make any difference if there was one founding father or if there were 10 founding fathers? What difference does that make? Since once you've gone on to the next generation, and certainly once you've gone a couple of hundred years later, it's not going to matter anyways. It's not going to have anything to do with the strength of the nation, since the example of the fathers is something which existed. It's not an example that plays a permanent, ongoing role in the lives of the children, so to speak. So what Moshe Rabbeinu was saying is that that's a vital element in the psyche of the nation, in the very identity of the nation. The fact that they retain with them the Derech HaAvos. And that if you're going to destroy this nation, so you're going to completely uproot all of that history. All of the lives of Avram, Yitzchak, all the different things that they did and everything that the results from that, that's been internalized into the psyche and it was passed down, and you have all, not to mention all the other people that base their lives on the example of the Avos. You're going to take that away and you're going to start from scratch, and it'll be just me. No matter how great that is, I cannot be duplicated. That's what he's saying. If the stool with the three legs, if all of that, the Torah, plus all of the examples of the Avos that have been established, if that is not sufficient in your time of anger, that is when the Jews sin, so it's going to be virtually impossible. How can you possibly achieve the same result if you uproot that and in its place you have the example of one person, myself? It's not going to do it. It won't work. What Rashi is saying, that Moshe is saying, if you intend to burn them, so look at what Avram was prepared to burn himself. He's making that point. It's an illustration of that point, that no matter how bad they are now, since they have within them that element of Schus Avos, and Schus Avos is something which can't be gotten from the history books. It has to do with identification, because we look back to them and recognize them as our ancestors. We have that identification. That is something which cannot be duplicated. And because of that, you cannot destroy the Jewish people. So Moshe Rabbeinu was able to achieve, because of his anivus, because of his humbleness, he was able to achieve a new level of appreciation for what Klal Yisrael is. And that's something that is very significant. It was a completely objective appreciation of Klal Yisrael. That's something which is lost today. There are many elements within the Jews themselves who are promoting, I would say, the destruction of Klal Yisrael. I don't mean to say that that's what their intention is, but they don't look at Klal Yisrael from the standpoint of Moshe Rabbeinu, of anivus, of humbleness, but rather they don't even have any appreciation of what Klal Yisrael is. They do not have an appreciation of what Klal Yisrael is. It's a very selfish approach. For example, many Jews that ordinarily have no interest in Judaism, or even the Jewish people, but as soon as the Jews are under attack and pressure, suddenly they discover their Jewishness and they go out marching for Israel. You can't do this. That's not real love of the Jewish people. That's an egotistical phenomenon. It's my ego because I'm Jewish. So these are people that pretty much are not interested in Judaism, or they have no concept of the Jewish people. However, if it touches them, if it's an affront to them because I'm Jewish. So if you attack the Jews, anti-Semitism, or if you attack Israel, now I'm going to fight against you. Okay, fine. I'm not condemning that. I'm merely saying that's a very selfish, egocentric approach. That's not based on any true appreciation of the Jewish people. And the same is true with other groups that have an agenda. They have an agenda. They want to promote their own ideas, their own system. But it's not based on what is objectively good for the Jewish people. It's certainly not even based on an understanding of what the Jewish people is. If you recognize what the Jewish people is, that it's an instrument which has been created by God to fulfill a purpose, and that purpose has to be fulfilled through the Torah, so why are you seeking to break down the Torah? To make these accommodations. Let me show you something else, which I think is not to be considered the Derech HaAvos. You have within what's called, loosely speaking, modern Orthodoxy. And I have to be very, very general over here. They just had a conference called the EIDA. You ever heard of EIDA? It's a grouping. I think, generally speaking, they identify themselves as modern Orthodox. You also have the other organization of Jewish feminists, Orthodox Jewish feminists. To a large extent, these types of organizations are dealing with the confrontation, you know, Orthodoxy in the modern world. And there's always a pressure. There is a pressure from people who consider themselves to be part of this contemporary society, and they're Jewish. And there's a pressure that stems from the fact that there have been many changes have taken place in modern society. For example, with regard to the role of women. That's one of them. So now, you've got to be very, very careful. Just because women have achieved a new status and are able to do certain things in secular society that they weren't able to do in the past. What does that mean when it comes to Torah? So there's a certain pressure that they want similar types of changes. They have an agenda. It's a feminist agenda. You can't impose any kind of an agenda on Torah. And the role of those people who defend Torah, who regard themselves as being orthodox, is not to try and find ways to finesse. I sometimes get the sense that what they're trying to do, because they do regard themselves as orthodox. On the other hand, they are under the influence, from a philosophical point of view, are very much in sympathy with certain things that are happening in the modern world, and there is a bit of a conflict, and sometimes the approach is to try and make an accommodation, to finesse, to bring it about in a way which, strictly speaking, may not be in violation of halacha. You're looking for all kinds of halachic gadgets and gimmickry. I know that's part of the feminist approach with issues, for example, women Torah readers or women's prayer groups and so on and so forth. Now, it seems to me that's not the derech ha'avos. We're going to talk about a derech. The true derech is to be honest, to be truthful, is to understand what the ideal of Torah is, and to be able to elucidate that ideal, to defend that ideal, to elucidate that ideal in a manner which is compelling to modern people. But you cannot undermine the ideal in any way. You can't change the ideal, because today people look at things differently. To say, for example, with regard to the issue, there was an article in the paper about a synagogue which bills itself as being traditional. Traditional is somewhere between conservative and an orthodox, but they regard themselves as being halachic. And they were describing how for the last year and a half or 2 years they've been grappling with the issue of women Torah readers, and they've been studying the issue, and then they finally voted on the issue, and they worked on this whole complicated system. And I don't know all the particulars of it. Then in the main sanctuary they won't have it, but in one of the side sanctuaries sometimes they will have it, and all the conditions that attach to it, and somehow or other This should conform. This resolves the problem. The whole idea is absolutely absurd, first of all, because you can't impose a democratic procedure in determining what the halacha ought to be. Does this make any sense? This is something which is the greatest insult, by the way, to all of the gedolim. Now, I'm not saying that the intention was to insult. The people sound very sincere and very serious. I'm not saying that they consciously intended to insult. But sometimes you can insult, what your activities can be very insulting. Let me give you an example. Would it make any sense for us to spend 2 years debating some type of medical procedure, heart surgery, or things of that sort, and we're going to vote and we're going to decide how certain procedures are going to be done, everybody would say we're fools. That's foolish because we're lay people. So if we read a few articles about something, we have a superficial understanding. At the same time, we recognize that that's a superficial understanding. But the authorities in this field are the experts in medicine. They're the field of medicine, and you need expertise. Well, what about Judaism? You're telling me that ordinary individuals, lay people, who may have read a few works that were translated into English very, very superficially, they're the ones who have the right to make these kinds of decisions? That is a disgrace of Torah. You're saying that that there's no such thing as expertise. There's no gedolim. There's no authorities. Well, what about all the great authorities that transmitted the Torah from generation to generation? So you see that even though that's not their intention, truth is they don't even realize what they're doing. But true Jewish leadership should get up and have the courage to say, this is false, this is wrong. That's the Derech HaAvos. This past year, at the beginning of the year, you remember when there was a chief rabbi of England and came out with a statement that Judaism does recognize the validity of other religions. I spoke out against it. I gave classes on it. But you didn't hear any outcry from Jewish leaders. I doubt very much that this was on the agenda of the Ada conference. How is it possible that Orthodox rabbis, what has happened to the interfaith dialogue to the extent that it's blurred the differences? And it's possible for someone to come out with a thing like this, which is a violation of one of the fundamentals of Judaism. No. Politics as usual. That's not the Derech HaAvos. The Derech HaAvos is not to find accommodation. That's not what they sought to do. The accommodation is through the elucidation of truth. Of course, you try and work with people, you want to be friendly with people, you want to explain it in a way which they can understand it, but the objective is not to accommodate, to find ways to accommodate people. If that is going to mean making changes in the values, in the ideals, or in the system, that's just an illustration of what I mean by not adhering to the Derech HaAvos. And the Derech HaAvos is something which is pretty much intangible. It may not be able to be written down on paper as a system, as a body of laws, but it's a reality. In order to be perfected as a Jew, one has to have a tremendous amount of knowledge, no question about it. But you have to have a sensitivity and an understanding of what I've referred to as Derech HaAvos, because in my opinion, that's a vital component of Yahadus, and this was the argument that Moshe used. That you can't destroy the Jewish people. So basically, the two arguments, to sum it up, the response of Moshe was that if you destroy the Jewish people, you can't destroy them because what we said at the very beginning, you can't destroy a chosen people. Then the entire objective of God in creation will not be able to be fulfilled. The first argument is because it'll produce a Chilul Hashem. The effect it'll have on mankind will be such that they won't be able to recover from it. So that's not specific to the Jewish people. The second one, however, is specific to the Jewish people. He recognized that it's not by accident that the Jews are the chosen people, but that only the Jews can be the chosen people, because he achieved a new degree of understanding of the role of Zechus Avos. Because of his great appreciation, his objective appreciation of that which is good for the Jewish people. That's what all Jewish leaders have to have. You can't have agendas. And you can't be just catering to people at this particular time to make changes to make them happier. You have to have a objective commitment and understanding of that which is in the best interest of the Jewish people, per se. That is the Derech of Moshe Rabbeinu, and that's the Derech of Avos. So it seems to me that by Moshe Rabbeinu's ability to reach this level, this was a whole new level. That's why the tefillah was effective. Because tefillah always works, in general, of course. Because the person, as a result of the tefillah, achieves a new degree of closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and is meritorious, deserves the help, deserves to be answered in terms of what he's asking. So, of course these ideas are true, and of course God knew these ideas, But the Jewish people had sunk to a very low level. So in order to raise the people to a higher level, one of the ways in which you raise the people to a higher level is by a change in one of the major components, a change in the leader. If the leader reaches a new level, so then by definition, that affects the entire people. And that's the idea of Moshe interceding. Moshe's recognition of these two ideas, the effect that the destruction of the Jews would have in terms of people's perception of God, and the second idea, the appreciation of the unique character of the Jewish people based upon the idea of Schus Avos, that this is something that cannot be duplicated, there cannot be another people that's like this people because of that factor, that appreciation put him on a different plane. And that was responsible for the fact that God listened to his tefillah.